We have had conflicting messages. I was told about the importance of being honest and about being good. Don't tell lies. Don't do this. Don't do that. And at the same time, when I was honest, when I expressed needs, you know, when I said or did something that was different from the expected, I was told that that was wrong, or I was given the impression that it was problematic and disappointing. And I think that a lot of us often feel obliged on some level to try to go along with what the other person wants.
That's Natalie Liu, and this is
A Social Life.
A Social Life.
A Social Life with Friends.
With Friends.
With Friends.
With Friends.
A Social Life with Friends. In this episode, I'm asking, how can we reframe people-pleasing and be okay with disappointing others? Before we dive into the episode, you might like to know that there's actually a companion newsletter to this podcast where you can get episode summaries, bonus links, and additional prompts to delve deeper and help you experiment with things for yourself. You can head to asociallifewithfriends.com to sign up to the newsletter. So what is people-pleasing? A people-pleaser can be defined as a person who feels a strong urge to placate or please other people, even at their own expense. They may say yes when they mean to say no, put other people's needs ahead of their own, or place their value in what other people think of them. As someone with people-pleasing tendencies, I wanted to delve into this particular behaviour not to admonish it, but rather understand it more, because I think it can encapsulate a lot of different tensions and misunderstandings. We're told to be good, to be honest, to tell the truth, and yet we people please because we've learned it's unsafe to be honest about certain things or to tell the truth about our wants, our desires, our thoughts. So to unravel this tension, in this episode we'll explore where people pleasing comes from, how it can prevent intimacy, and what we can do to reframe it. Here's more from Natalie Liu, a writer, artist, and author of The Joy of Saying No, on how people pleasing can be viewed in different ways.
When we think about how people-pleasing has tended to be seen in society, we have, on one end, people, as you say, seeing it as, oh, I'm such a good person because I'm a people-pleaser, you know, seeing it as a sign of virtue, as a sign of goodness, a signaling of all of their good qualities. And then on the other end, you have people who see people-pleasing as being a doormat. And one of the things I really stress with this is that people-pleasing is really a pattern that we have learned, a habit that we have learned in response to anxiety and trauma. And it has also inadvertently become our way of managing trauma and anxiety. It has been our way of managing conflict.
As Natalie touches on, people-pleasing can be a habit we form in response to anxiety, stress, or trauma. It was interesting for me to learn about a lesser-known stress response behind my own people-pleasing, which is fawning. You might already know about the fight or flight response. And so the fawn response can look a lot like doing things for others to gain their approval or make other people like you, or being overly reliant on others, prioritizing the needs of other people and ignoring your own, being overly agreeable and having trouble saying no or even disassociating. Fawning is a way to cover up our own distress. Even though we might value things like generosity, helpfulness, and even kindness, in some contexts, such traits can lead to a harmful pattern of self-sacrifice or self-neglect. Natalie shares more about how this habit of people-pleasing stems from a societal pressure to be good.
As we know, the world tends to take a quite binary view about a lot of things. And so when we look at how we run a lot of our lives, you can see that a lot of stuff comes down to good versus bad. And so as a society, we have internalized and reinforced these ideas of what constitutes good and what constitutes bad. But of course, that varies depending on the time we're living in, the community we're in, you know, what our family's like, all sorts of factors in that. And it is not that we're not a quote unquote good person. It's not that we're not kind and loving and all of those things. But when we get more honest about the why behind a lot of the things that we do, and also the toll of the so-called good things that we're doing, What we get to see is that good things are not supposed to feel so bad. We shouldn't have to give up our emotional, mental, physical, spiritual well-being. We shouldn't have to give up our hopes and desires, all so that we can fit somebody's idea of what it means to be a so-called good person.
But what does good actually mean? When researching her book, Natalie learned about the etymology of the word good and how its origins connect to religion and virtue, and how that has morphed and expanded throughout history.
There is an industrial revolution, there's colonization, there's imperialism, all happening over a rather intense period where you've got people being moved across the world to different places. You've got the sort of the factory life. We were both consumers of goods, but we were also the makers of it as well, you know, moving away so much from farming into other types of work. And then education coming in, so the schooling as well. You can see then how good started to be about wealth. Good people have more money than others. So there's a real sort of class thing going on there. Good was also about women. There's a saying, children should be seen and not heard. But actually, it started off as being young women should be seen and not heard. Good was then became about sort of your work ethic as such. So it became about worship, it became about wealth, it became about work ethic. It also, let's be real, when you're talking about marginalized groups, became about, for instance, proximity to whiteness, but also proximity to what was seen as, you know, the standard of goodness and normality. And you can see then as a society how now we are kind of experiencing the after effects of all of that.
So what are some of these after effects? What is the toll of this tension that comes with being good? How does people pleasing, in fact, disrupt connection rather than build it? For Natalie, this people pleasing or trying to be good can often become corrosive to the soul.
Look, there's nothing wrong per se with wanting to do good things, but it is the why behind it that creates the issue that becomes corrosive, because there are people who, for instance, want to help others or who will stay behind at work, you know, or work, you know, longer, or they'll sacrifice certain things, but they don't do it because they have an underlying sense of low self-worth. They don't do it because they are afraid of what will happen if they don't do it. They're not doing it because on some level they're trying to influence and control other people's feelings and behavior. You know, there's some sort of level of hidden agenda, like, oh my gosh, if I do this, then maybe I'm going to be rewarded with that, or I'm going to get to avoid this other painful situation. And that's the corrosion, because pretending to be something we're not, telling people what we think they want to hear, you know, saying yes when we really mean no, treating ourselves like machines, acting as if we have no needs, desires, expectations, feelings, and opinions of our own, takes a toll on our emotional, mental, physical, and spiritual well-being. We're just not designed to live our lives this way.
The thing about people-pleasing is that in trying so hard to avoid disappointing people, we can actually end up disappointing them more in the long run. For example, we might say yes to someone to avoid disappointing them in the short term, but then when we realize we can't follow through with that commitment and we have to let them down in the future, it's actually letting them down even more than if we had said no to begin with, because now there is that sense of commitment and someone's relying on us. It can be a bit of a mess. And as Natalie put it, when we're people-pleasing, we're actually creating a debt.
You know, one of the things I say is that people-pleasing is like creating a debt and then expecting other people to pay it off.
We might fear disappointing other people, but it's actually how we navigate these disappointments that actually builds intimacy and trust. A little while ago, I came across the advice to trust people who value being honest more than they value being nice. This really stopped me in my tracks and had me rethinking my people-pleasing. I don't think it's necessarily always a choice between being honest and being nice. I think that hard truths can be delivered compassionately, but hard truths are hard and they have the potential to disappoint other people. When you're afraid to disappoint other people, avoiding the truth feels easier. Yet delaying honesty only gets you more of the things you don't want. That's what I think is corrosive to the soul. Delaying honesty is delaying the life we want. In thinking this through, what I've realized is that being honest with others requires a strong foundation, Someone needs to be open to hearing our feelings and opinions, and we need to be ready to share them. Some situations aren't worth the investment, and others can become impossible, as what is said is not heard, or what is heard is not what was said. So deciding when to be honest becomes a matter of discernment. That said, I think that reframing our people-pleasing tendencies can help us be honest in more scenarios. So how do we do that? Something to consider is that in approaching our people-pleasing tendencies, we have to admit to them. And when we do that, we can experience shame because we realize just how corrosive it's been to ourselves or to our relationships. Again, societally, we think of pleasing others as good, but it can actually be a way of deceiving others, either to protect ourselves or to delay the truth, as we spoke about.
And when we realize this, we have to be compassionate with ourselves. We have to recognize that we have been socialized and conditioned into people-pleasing. It is very, very hard to avoid having some element of it in your life because it's how we have been raised. It's what society has been about really for a good several hundred years or so, probably even longer. And so we have to cut ourselves some slack and also start to be more mindful about how we are being disingenuous because we like to think, oh my God, you know, I'm so good. You know, I've been so generous and I've been this and that. And when we realize that actually there is an element of, and it's the word that most people pleasers feel uncomfortable with, there's an element of manipulation in there. Not in the sense of, you know, I am trying to, you know, coercively control somebody into something. But at the same time, we're doing something with the hope that it will change the other person's feelings or behavior, or that we will get what we want out of it, or we will avoid something else. And that can be a lot to confront.
Such realizations about ourselves isn't a reason for reproach, though. It's simply a signal to become more mindful of ourselves. As Natalie put it, the first step to reframing people-pleasing is to cultivate self-awareness.
To manage that tension, we have to be more aware of the self. And being more aware of the self doesn't mean that we become a selfish person. We start to realize that we are, you know, the stewards of our bandwidth, of our boundaries. We are, you know, the keepers of our needs, you know, the feelers of our feelings and the thinkers of our thoughts. And only we have a sense of what's going on within and have a sense of what does and doesn't feel good and right for us. And how that looks for us is going to be different from someone else. And what we then realize is disappointment is an actual integral part of life, that people are supposed to be disappointed. They're not supposed to hear yes all the time. And they're definitely not supposed to hear a disingenuous yes, you know, like, oh, yeah, sure. And then behind the scenes is something else because we damage the intimacy of our relationships. And I think that when we prioritize not only our values, but our sense of, you know, if we want that intimacy and connection, for instance, in our relationships, hate to break it to people, but we have to start learning to say no and to also start saying yes more honestly, because that's where the intimacy comes in. And then we all know where we stand.
Cultivating self-awareness is about noticing how we're feeling. Related to this, I love what Natalie said about resentment. We might think that resentment is about someone else's frustrating, annoying, or disappointing behavior. But as Natalie pointed out, when resentment is in the room, it's a sign that we've been overgiving somewhere.
Yeah, I would say that resentment is probably one of my big notification feelings. Like the moment that it's in the room, I'm like, uh-oh. Then it's almost like you have one of those charts, you know, that lights up and you can see like the map and the path. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh God, there's the overgiving. And it can be about small things or about big things. But the moment that resentment shows up, it is time for me to be like, ah, Natalie, it's time to check yourself. And that's been a massive eye-opener for me because you're so right. When we feel resentful, which obviously is a form of anger, it's like this person has done something to me or they have taken advantage of me. The injustice of it all. I've been made to do something. I had no choice in it. actually, that's often not the case. More often than not, it is about the people pleasing, particularly around the overgiving. And I think a lot of our work practices these days are really built on overgiving. And, you know, you're a creative, you know, working for yourself. You know, I'm a creative working for myself. And it is so easy to see all of these things that we're doing as boom, creativity, and not see where some of it has turned into overgiving. And that for me was something that stopped me in my tracks and forced me to make big, immediate decisions to change that feeling that I was experiencing.
So what are some of the big changes we can make? I think we can start by trying to let go of what other people think. As it's been said, you wouldn't worry so much about what other people think of you if you realize how seldom they do. What I'll add to that is that often when we're worrying about what other people think of us, we're really just worrying about what we think they think. That's not only a really imprecise guessing game, it actually has no bearing on who we are. If we're worried about someone being mad at us, it's actually up to them to tell you the truth. That's what intimacy is. So just as it's our responsibility to cultivate self-awareness and be honest, it's up to others to do the same. It can take a long time to discern what is and isn't our responsibility in all of this. For writer Holly Whitaker, such a process was interwoven with her own recovery from addiction.
Disappointing people was not something that was in my DNA until really I had to disappoint people, meaning I disappointed people with my decisions and my self-preservation in my recovery in ways that were deeply uncomfortable for a person like me who I'm very attuned to other people and also historically has friendships by giving something of herself to have them. And so it's like this, it's kind of like this muscle that I think I built over the years. And it's very strange because I still am really impacted by other people, you know, like what they think of me or like their energy. But what's changed is I just don't internalize it. I don't really fucking care. You know, I just don't think I'm responsible for other people's feelings. I don't mean that in a reckless way, but I mean that like I'm totally okay with somebody being whatever, having an adverse reaction to a choice I'm making that's in my best interest or that I need to make, you know, to support myself. Like, and if you are operating in such a way where you really are prioritizing your mental health, your energy, your emotional balance. And I think like it takes more work than we really actually give it credit for. Like it takes
over time. It's actually become a joyful thing to disappoint other people because it was a sign of self-responsibility.
And one of the things that I have worked on is repeating, and I still repeat it daily as an affirmation, it's not me. And so I think by having worked so hard on breaking up with this idea that I'm responsible for other people and actually really focusing on, no, you're responsible for yourself, it's given me a freedom I can't even express. It's joy to realize, not me, sorry.
What I love about this is that if we are practicing saying no, if we see disappointing other people as something that can be joyful, if we tell the awkward or hurtful truth, we actually give other people permission to do the same. Disappointment is part of the human experience. It's a part of navigating our relationships. And one way to get better at disappointing other people is to realize that other people disappoint us.
Yeah, because the funny thing is, and I think that this is the quintessential problem that we experience as people pleasers, is we spend so much of our lives avoiding no, that when other people turn around and say no to us, it feels very wounding at times. Because there's a part of us going, but hold on a second, I say yes all the time, even when I don't want to, so why can't you? And when we confront this in ourselves, we realize, oh, hold on a second, like, what about if I were more honest with my yeses and my noes, then I would be better placed in my relationships. I wouldn't be sitting around on a whole load of resentment and feeling wounded.
I think that other people saying no to us can give us confidence to say no to others.
One of the things I've noticed about myself, and I think that that's given me more confidence about going back to people, is that I invite people to things or I ask people to do things and people don't say yes to me all the time. You know, like I literally had a party the other day and there was like a whole lot of people that couldn't make it, right? I felt a little bit disappointed in the sense of, oh gosh, that sucks that they won't be there. But I wasn't like, oh my gosh, like they said that they can't be there, you know, making it a whole story in my head. And so I thought to myself, well, if I can give people the grace to say no to me and I can live through that disappointment and I'm not thinking anything bad about them afterwards, why can't I extend the same thing to myself?
Saying no can be what builds intimacy. In episode 3 of this podcast on making resolutions for your social life, Natalie also shared how saying no can be almost like a litmus test for our relationships and how honest we can be in them. She also shared an experiment that involves spending a week surveying your yeses and your noes. I recommend you go back to listen to that episode, but I was curious to get Natalie's advice on how to deal with a situation where you've already said yes due to your people-pleasing, and now you have to untangle yourself and disappoint someone in the process.
Something I suggest to people, and that includes myself, who do sometimes straddle that thing of, well, I wanted to before, but now I don't, or vice versa, is the power of the pause, which is at the time when we are asked to do this thing or we decide that we're going to do this thing, we're probably the people who need to really have a bit of a pause and reflection and think, okay, what have I got going on at the moment? And when I think about those things, I'm like, based on what I know about myself, am I likely to change my mind? Possibly. Is there a possibility of that? And if my answer to that is yes, I tend to try to give myself more time before I'm going to commit to it. And that gives me a lot of wiggle room. I would also say, though, that it's looking at, are you somebody who sort of reflexively says yes or reflexively gets excited about things that you know are potentially of interest to you? Because again, nothing wrong with, you know, being excited and interested about things, but I, like you, I do overestimate how much capacity I have for stuff. I then am like, oh my gosh, like how did I end up like putting this on myself? So now I tend to try to be at about 70%. Whatever I've come up with, I'll try to figure, what's 70% of that? Because I'm always going to overdo it, or I'm possibly going to overestimate or underestimate the time. And if you understand this about yourself, you can be super mindful about that. And you start to have more of a sense of where you are quite likely to change your mind. Like, I've literally just changed my mind about something yesterday. I knew, and this is another clue, it was not something I didn't want to do. I want to do the thing. But I knew after I had said, sure, I'd be up for doing that, that I could hear hear almost in my head, oh gosh, yeah, but you got this thing and are you going to have time to do this and blah, 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 blah. And I could hear all these kind of niggly little things. And that was telling me that even though I want to do the thing, I do not have the capacity, or it's not the best day for me to do it then. And so I went back to them and I was like, actually, I know I said I could, but I can't. And they were like, okay, that's fine.
My relief was palpable when Natalie described the "it's fine" she received. There is something so refreshing and simple in saying, I know I said I could, but I can't. I can recall a time when I had to pull out of something and my friend said that all timing is good timing, meaning that telling her now was better than telling her later. Not only did I feel relief in that, but I also felt like it built a sense of closeness. In a similar vein, I think it's important to remember we only learn a lesson when we learn it. We can berate ourselves for not having stronger boundaries to begin with, or for not seeing our patterns of people-pleasing sooner, but we can only learn a lesson when we learn it. And so, to conclude, I think it's about remembering to have self-compassion as well. And perhaps the best way to do that is to keep things simple.
We need to not overcomplicate it. And what I mean by this is that I find that the big barrier to saying no, to understanding what it is that we need and want so that we know what to say yes to, our resistance around boundaries comes from those fears that you brought up earlier on, you know, that fear of the conflict and, you know, disappointing and all the rest. But no is just the inverse of yes. So whatever you're saying no to, you're saying yes to something else and vice versa. And we are our boundaries and values. Everything that we say and don't say, do and don't do, is expressing our self-esteem. It's expressing who we are, what we're about. So our values, our preferences, principles, and priorities, and our boundaries, our sense of our limits, what does and doesn't feel good and right for us. And if we can recognize that actually we can at any time, you know, use what is happening in our lives, in our body, to get a sense of what we need to say yes to, but also what we need to say no to, we can make things so much easier for ourselves. We also don't need to get it, quote unquote, right. Like, it's an evolution. Yeah. So we know ourselves as much as we can know ourselves right now. I don't think we need to sit there and be like, I know myself 100%, because we are evolving. Things will shift. There are different life stages, different challenges that we will go through, also different joys that we're going to experience. And everything that's happening in our lives is giving us a sense of, oh, that works for you, or, oh, that doesn't work for you, or, oh, you need to kind of tweak that a little bit. I think if we can cut ourselves some slack and really start to distinguish ourselves from others, I think we've just been so conditioned to think, I'm the same as my family, or I have to be the same as my friends, or I have to be the same as the people that I say that I identify with. Okay. And also, who are you? Like, what's true for you? Like, it doesn't have to be either or. There can also just be an and. And I think that if we just give ourselves the space to listen in, what's that little whisper within? What keeps niggling at us? But also, some of those things, you know, those frustrations, those are clues about who we are, right? What we need. If we are willing to pay attention and we stop forcing ourselves to be and do things that really don't suit, we will know ourselves better. And we'll free ourselves up to have better lives.
Thanks for listening to A Social Life with Friends. If you'd like to have a summary of these approaches to reframing people-pleasing, you can head to asociallifewithfriends.com to become a paid supporter and receive the bonus episode summary. Of course, you can also sign up to the newsletter for free and show support by subscribing to the podcast wherever you like to listen. I'd love it if you left a positive review if you enjoyed the episode, and maybe it's the perfect thing to share with a friend and bring a bit of connection to your day. So much about reframing people-pleasing is about listening to those whispers of what we really want, rather than worrying about what other people think. And so I want to leave you with the words of Dr. Seuss. Be who you are and say what you feel, because those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind.